I'd like to talk tonight about conditions for insight. As I mentioned this afternoon, there really aren't different levels of awareness. But it's useful to distinguish three ways that human beings experience awareness. One way we could call ordinary awareness. The second is meditative awareness. And the third would be what's called pure awareness. Now, ordinary awareness would be sort of often what is there, say, first thing in the morning when there's wakefulness out of sleep and there's kind of a recognition that you're in your room, you're on your bed, you're in the house, and then there may be a whole pretty quick to appear story, you know, about yourself and your life and what you're going to do and what you did, and there may be a memory there and there may be a plan there. And awareness of these things, okay, we could call ordinary awareness. It's the awareness that many humans use when they're sort of taking care of business. They're getting things done and they're living life in many ways as many people know it. Now, meditative awareness, okay, is the awareness that we're cultivating here, so to speak. Sometimes it's called mindfulness. The difference between ordinary awareness and meditative awareness is that in meditative awareness we begin to see more clearly not just what is happening, but we begin to see what is happening to what is happening. Okay, so ordinary awareness would perhaps just notice that there's a breath here. Meditative awareness would allow us to see that this breath is changing. It's never the same. It arises and it passes. And, obviously then, it doesn't last. Now, what I just said about the breath is true about every experience. And if we start with this meditative awareness of, say, breath as a base, which many traditions do, not just in Buddhist traditions, but other traditions utilize the breath as an object of awareness, to begin to see the actual nature of life in that form. Yeah? The nature of life in that form is, as I mentioned, ever-changing, never the same, and impermanent. Now, what that means is that this sitting here, this body, this mental emotional process that appears in this body, its true nature is the same as the breath true nature. So to see the true nature, yeah, through meditative awareness of the breathing, might seem very easy. But to see the true nature of this, different story. So meditative awareness, yeah, for some humans, is more seemingly naturally there. You ever met someone who's sort of naturally contemplative? I met some people like this when I was younger, and it really seemed to me that they had something that I didn't have, which seemed to me like they were more peaceful. They were more at ease. They seemed more observant. They seemed more aware. They seemed more alert, but they didn't seem more uptight. See, I felt I'm more uptight. You seem less uptight. And these are all just my conjectures, right? Because I didn't really talk to these people very much. I just observed them. And then I had my own associations to what I thought I was seeing. Okay. You ever have that sense? Someone has something I don't. Someone's experiencing something I haven't. And even more seductive, that looks good. And maybe I want that. Okay. That's not necessarily just ignorance driving that. Could be some wisdom tucked in there. Now, pure awareness okay, is something that emerges out of, you could say, meditative awareness. So I'm going to talk about this a little bit. Pure awareness, okay, is a very, very liberating experience, but it's an experience like all others that comes and goes. Pure awareness is when the subject, in this case awareness, and the apparent objects, yeah, things that are happening, experiences, show in their true nature no separation. So the experience of feeling separate goes away. Could go away for a second, could go away for a minute, could go away for an hour, could go away altogether. Okay? No more separation. That's pure awareness. So as you look at these three types of awareness, okay, can you see the possibility of moving from various degrees of habituation? By the way, when I say habituation, that's often some degrees of limitation. From perceived limitation or restriction into greater openness or greater wholeness. If you like, you could say greater completeness or fulfillment. So the whole thrust is moving from unawakenedness to awakenedness. And this is true through all the spiritual traditions, all the methods. If you boil them down, it's about coming out of unawakenedness into awakenedness, into seeing things clearly, into waking up, as some people say. It's the object or thrust of all the traditions and practices. And I'll try to show you how that connects with St. Francis, since we're in the Franciscan Center. And if he's looking down on us now, well, let me hold off on that. Maybe he'll like that part of the talk. Okay, so most of us spend a fair amount of time in the experience of our lives within what could be called the subject-object dichotomy. Okay? The subject-object dichotomy, meaning there's everything that appears, these are the objects, and then there's this witnessing or watching awareness as the subject. Now, this witnessing or watching awareness is very easily identified with as oneself. I am that. That occurs sometimes when there's a belief or view, and it's assumed, it's not experienceable, that this watching is actually a watcher. That there's a watcher up here watching stuff. Now, if there's a watcher up here watching stuff, our task would be show it to somebody else. Put your finger on it. Identify it, locate it. What's actually happening is that there is watching, yet no watcher. There's watching, yet no watcher. See this now if you can. And if you try to see it, you can't. And yet it can be seen. Or noticed. It's very simple. And yet, at times, apparently elusive. Because it's so here, it's so obvious, that it's easily overlooked. Why? Because I identify myself as the watcher. This is one kind of identification. Now, it doesn't often just stop there. It also proliferates out, and I identify myself as the objects of experience. I am the feelings, I am the thoughts, I am the breathing, I am the sense perceptions, I am the body. Just to name a few. Of course, we don't stop just there. We go out further, and we go, I am the owner of this, I'm the owner of that. This is mine. The title for the house has my name on it. My house. My car. My cushion. My chair. My blanket. My bed. My toothpaste. My toothpick. My paperclip. My paperclip! Who got my paperclip? Right out. See this? Right out. Blankets itself over things. Claims. Ownership. More or less. Subject, awareness. Object, the things of life, experiences. Apparent dichotomy. In actuality, there's no dichotomy. There's no dichotomy between the subject and object. The subject and the object are completely inseparable. Notice that any object, and when I say object, I mean experience, that's appearing in any moment cannot be separated from awareness, can it? Inseparable. And yet this subject-object dichotomy has proliferated itself in the mind of humans, not just because some of them took up Descartes' teaching when he said, I think, therefore I am, but this identifying tendency, this I tendency, has not been investigated thoroughly. The appearance, very important word, the appearance or sense of separation between the subject and the objects appears because of identification with either the watching or awareness or the objects or both. Watch closely, if you like, through this talk to see the identifying tendency. Has the same nature as the breath. Appears, disappears. We don't often see this, but we have no problem whatsoever, in many cases, releasing from identification as we fall into deep sleep. Forget about it all. 4 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours, 7 hours. Love it. And without that rest, we go a little kooky. And kooky people sometimes try to extract information out of people through depriving them of sleep. It's a form of torture. It's been used and still is used. When there's no identification with the subject or the objects of life for an instant, for a moment, for a minute, what's going on then? What's going on then is a continuum, yeah, which is a beautiful flow of life. That's what life is, it's a flow. And when there is no identification with I am watching it or I am the things being watched, this so-called dichotomy dissolves and there's open, fluid continuum. That's pure awareness. When it arises for some humans, they think they're enlightened. We'll footnote that and come back to that. Okay, it's an experience. all experiences come and go. So meditation practice, then, very key. Meditation practice, as we're practicing it, it has the power to remove, to dissolve, what's called false perception, which in another set of words would be called misunderstanding, which in another set of words would be called ignorance, which simply means not seeing things clearly, not seeing the truth clearly. Delusion is there. Yeah? Delusion is a kind of false perception. Confusion is a kind of false perception. The fundamental false or wrong perception is the identification with the subject or the objects of life, or both. And this is why human beings suffer. That's the essence of it. That's the core. Now, we can suffer for lots of other reasons. We can be unhappy for lots of other reasons. But if we track those reasons back, which is actually very difficult to do in some cases, what I'm talking about will be revealed. I'm talking about the root. And if we're interested, and not all of us might be, us here on this weekend might be more interested than some folks that are going to go out and party it up tonight. On the other side of the river, perhaps, because it does happen. Right across the river, the parties kick in. They might have a little bit of a different interest for how they'd like their night to go than seeing through the subject-object dichotomy and experiencing pure awareness. But actually, if you could slow them down for a moment in between the dance and the music and the conversation and the refreshment, and ask them what they really want. And you could cut through the layers that are often at the surface when that question's asked. They might want the same thing that all human beings want. We might truly all be in it together, not just in this room, in that sense. So what happens when there's an identification with the subject or the objects is that there's actually a contraction. Little or a lot, there's a narrowing of the totality of life. There's a shrinking. And that shrinking is actually the effect of the false perception of separation. Because it's the identifying tendency that creates the separation. Now you might say, okay, let me see if I can not have any identifying tendency with anything. That's identifying tendency with trying to not have identifying tendency. That's not how it comes free. So then you might ask a question, how does it come free? How does this identifying tendency come free? Guess what? It's already free. It's free to appear and disappear. Just like the breath. Just like dinner. Just like 3 o'clock this afternoon. Just like anything that you ever could remember and say, that happened. We have very subtle, and often not so subtle, views and opinions about what freedom is. Like freedom is a feeling, and it's a gesture, and it's a, it's a, you know, it's a, ooh. It's all these different ideas, and it is that, and it's not that at the same time. Or you might say, it is that, and it's not limited to that. Okay, the floor, for example, as we call it, right? Flower is already free as itself. It's so free it doesn't even consider itself as free, probably. Water bottle, free as itself. It's free as itself now. We seem to be the only critters walking around here who think we're not free. You notice that? I'm saying this as a possibility. The identifying tendency does not liberate itself, you might say, through someone trying to not have it happen. Try to not have the identifying tendency happen. Give it a shot. Watch where it goes. It would be really difficult to even maintain just a steady posture if you really worked at that. You'd probably just start to really go like this. Try to not identify. No, it's part of the nature of unfolding experience. Why spend time trying to figure out where it comes from? Why not just see it for what it is? I'm talking about insight now. Seeing it for what it is. See what happens to it then. So we could be watching the identifying tendency, the making of the I, me, and I added the mine. I, me, mine. Condition. It's a condition. True nature. Our true nature is like the great clear sky. As an image, great clear sky. Cloudless sky. All phenomena of body-mind, including all sense perceptions, that suggest there's an external world. You know why there appears to be an external world? It's because there's senses that suggest that. Actually, it's more subtle than that. There's perceptions that suggest. There's a perception that there's an outside and an inside. When there's no identifying tendency with awareness or objects, part of what goes away is the sense of inside and outside. This happens very, very frequently for people, even if they're not meditating, but they miss it. They overlook it. So the sense perceptions suggest to me there's an external world. With the addition of the false perception, when I say false perception, I simply mean it's not true nature. It's confused. And not just that, but it generates unhappiness, because what it does is active enough, it creates the sense of aloneness, isolation, loneliness. And after a certain amount of that kind of experience, most human beings try to do something to get out of that. They try to change that experience of isolation or aloneness or separateness. What if there's no external world? What if there's no internal world? What would that mean? It would mean ease. It would mean resting. It wouldn't mean we all become incapacitated and can't act. And we just do nothing forever. It would mean our actions would be liberated so much more than perhaps we've ever imagined. Uninhibited. Because we wouldn't be trying to fit the world together, we wouldn't be trying to understand things, we wouldn't be trying to fix ourselves. We wouldn't be trying to join with other things. We'd realize fundamentally we're already in the club and we have a permanent membership and that you can't get booted out. You can't lose your membership. And even more so, you've never not been a member. And we're talking about the club, if you will, of freedom or happiness, contentment. So all phenomena, whether you call it internal, and many of us have this perception of internal experience and external experience, all this occurs in the clear sky of our real nature. The sky is forever clear, and it's unaffected by what appears in it. Now, this is very important here. The sky is still clear even when there's clouds in it. Notice the perception that would say, cloudy, no, the sky's not clear. How often have we said, clear, not clear sky? Weather person says, not clear sky today. A little not clear sky day. The sky is clear beyond the clouds. The sky is never clouded, no matter what's in it. Now that's an image or a metaphor, if you will, for how true nature or real nature is never obscured. Everything arises and vanishes on its own, very important, on its own, in the clear sky of true nature. Just like, for example, you're sitting, sticking with the breath is another example, and you have a moment of realizing that there's no one doing this breath. That's actually the experience, subtle as it may be, or brief as it may be, of anatta or no self. In Theravada Buddhism, one of the deepest teachings is the teaching of anatta, that there's no independent or separate I or me or self to whom things are happening. So in the simplicity of just observing the breathing, sometimes, it just pops clear, very simply, without much drama, fanfare. Breath is breathing itself. There's no I or me breathing the breath. Now the I or me as a thought form or concept can come right back as quick as it seemed to disappear. Boop, it's right back in. I'm breathing. Oh, I'm not breathing. Oh, I'm watching myself breathing. I'm watching myself not breathing. It's faster than... Have you ever watched some of those young Chinese teenagers who've been playing ping pong since they were like 2? And their pre-Olympic stage, right? Goes so fast. I watched YouTube of Bruce Lee, that karate guy, before he passed away. And he had the sticks, the muchacas, with the chains in between. And he's playing ping pong with the muchachas. And he wins. He beats this other guy. And the stick is as wide as the ping pong ball. A little bit of concentration. Not necessarily pure awareness. Even when what's happening appears to cloud or obscure the sky, the sky is never obscured or clouded. And all phenomena, all experience, arises and passes by nature freely. This is part of freedom in relativity, is to see that everything comes and goes. It's the law. It's the truth. It's the Dharma. And when that's clear, when that's seen, yeah, there's a release or an illumination within relativity or within the field of conditionality. such that conditionality, yeah, arising and passing of experiences, does not impinge in the same way. So we're talking here about seeing how things arise and pass, and as we continue to practice, we'll continue to do this, not just with the breathing, but into the body, into the hearing experience, into the visual experience. As we see the arising, many of us see the arising, we feel this is life happening. And when there's passing, if what's passing is unpleasant, we go, oh good, it's gone. But if what is passing is pleasant and we liked it, we go, oh no. And sometimes it goes right to, can I maybe recreate that? Could I have that again? Maybe I'll just sit a little differently so that comes back. Trying to control it. The nature, yeah, is that everything comes and goes in its own time, not our time. Now we manipulate this sometimes by trying to have it on our schedule. And this can even happen in the practice. Something comes up and one starts breathing and trying to have that experience go away. If I breathe just a little deeper, maybe I could just kind of push it out with my out-breath. Especially if it starts kind of hurting inside, it's uncomfortable. See if I can push that out, because my massage therapist said, just breathe into it, Paul. Breathe into it, baby. Just breathe it out of your knee. Do you know how many people can't breathe out of their knee? Everyone. You can't breathe out of... It's a metaphor. Or just go all the way down. Breathe out your feet. Just let it go out your feet. Cleanse it, Paul. Just detoxify. You'll feel better. And even if you get some of that to happen, like you get a feeling of opening there, it doesn't take long at all for the misery to be back. It could be the next morning you wake up and you go, oh, now the other spot hurts. I had a fellow that I meditated with in room side by side for a long period of time. And I knew he had it together more than me, at least I thought he did. Watch that, see that perception? I thought he had it together more than me. Now what we had is these two rooms where we meditated, his room, my room, and then we had a shared walking hall with a sink. Okay? And then we'd each go out at different periods of time to get our food and we'd come back. Okay? So we had a schedule set up, so he'd do the walking, I'd do the sitting, and then we'd reverse it, yeah? So we could use the space correctly. After doing this, I was in that space with him for about 2 months. And at the end, he said to me, first thing he said to me, it was very interesting, he said to me, you tap your toothbrush twice. That was a Zen koan. Zen koan is something the mind can't necessarily understand. In fact, it's not supposed to be able to understand. You tap your toothbrush twice. As soon as he said that to me, I realized that I'd only been vaguely aware of that thing that I'd been doing pretty much ever since I'd been brushing my teeth. And when he said it to me, he smiled. It was a beautiful teaching. You tap your toothbrush twice. Once I received that from him, then I said, tell me about your practice. He said, and I like this one almost better than the toothbrush one, he said, if it isn't one spot that hurts, it's another. Now this is a character who'd done 9 3-month retreats. That means a 3-month retreat. So if you, 12 months in the year, yeah? 3 months of the 12, he's in intensive meditation like we're doing. And this is his 10th year doing this. And that's actually lightweight compared to what some folks do. Steve and I recently spent some time with a teacher who's off to a 3-year retreat. And it's, I believe, second or third 3-year retreat in his life, and he's in his 30s. Why would you want to do that? Can I let that question rest for a moment? Maybe come back. Why would you want to do that? All right, let's put the other half in. Why would you not want to do that? Lots of reasons. Seeing how things vanish on their own, how things cease on their own, is very, very important. Because as we see how things cease on their own, we begin to experience that living and dying are not separate. That arising, which we sometimes call living, and passing, which we sometimes call dying, are not separate. They're a continuum. And this is extremely handy in a lot of different ways. But the one I want to speak about specifically is that seeing this truth of arising and passing, the wave appears and disappears, doesn't it? We've watched this many times. Wave came, wave went. Rain came, rain went. Sun rose, sun went down. What we fail to see until we see it is that everything that's happening is governed by that law, that truth. And it's wonderful, liberating news. It's not bad, pejorative, pessimistic, depressed, or negative. It's the truth. Now, what happens spontaneously is the more deeply that's seen, the tendency to cling to life, to hold on to life, to grasp at life, releases, not because anybody makes it release, but because it releases when this revelation, or truth, if you will, or realization, of arising and passing appears. When it appears very, very deeply, the clinging dissolves very, very deeply. When it appears a little bit of clinging can dissolve. So the point that I want to make is that sometimes we have a tendency, some of us more than others, to try to figure out things through looking at our past, trying to resolve the issues that we feel we're still carrying around, which is part of psychology and it has its place. There's a much more efficient and direct way, is to see how everything that arises, including any memories, any emotions, any ideations, any beliefs about anything, including the most painful things that could ever happen to us, are by nature changing. Now, as you see that change, you haven't even seen the dissolution of it. It hasn't gone away completely, but it's changing. As you see that changing, what's allowing you to see that is meditative awareness. If we could see this truth without the help of meditation, we don't need to continue. We can just go across the river, maybe. I'm not gonna, but you could. You know, and some of us have this tendency. You know, life is hard, so have as good time as you can, party when you can, enjoy, have sense pleasure, enjoy it, and we make the most of it, and we don't face the identifying tendency, we don't face impermanence, we don't face the possibility, we don't line up to the possibility that we could be free here and now. We sell out, and we satisfy ourselves also temporarily with something that's also fleeting. Nothing wrong with that. It's not a lower consciousness. It's just something that human beings sometimes do. Figuring out the causes of things is an endless process. Seeing clearly how the mind, by nature, whatever we call the mind or the body, by nature arises and passes, uproots the figuring out habit. Because if we were successful in figuring something out, I want to think about this, sort this out, do all that, why is that? Because I want relief from that thing if it's bugging me. That's why I talk to other people about things that are bugging me. That's why I write about them. That's why I use an affirmation to try to have a different experience. It's because I'm trying to untie myself from that issue. There's a much more direct way to become free of issues. And by the way, the issues that we feel or experience are always personal, even if somebody else in our world who we care for or don't care for seems to have the issue. It's still my issue if I've got a problem. And I could say it's them. That's called, in this tradition here, the Vipassana Vendetta. There's somebody on the retreat who just is not okay with you. And it's probably not yet the case here. If we stayed here for 2 months, I can guarantee you it would probably come up. And the other side would be the Vipassana romance might come up too. You'd fall in love with somebody's big toe. No. Or just, you'd go by them and all of a sudden this smell would hit you, which would be sort of a natural body odor or something that they put on, and you just go, and you swoon for a second. Because you're so open and vulnerable, you can't help yourself but just fall into things. Because everything just opens up to that extent. I thought my chest was going to explode with happiness after practicing for a while once. I became afraid that I was going to have a heart attack of the best kind. And I'd be hospitalized, and then the fear of, like, contracted things. So figuring things out is an endless process. And if we could figure our way to happiness, if we could use an affirmation, if we could change our diet and stretch our back and get a good night's sleep and watch our tongue and try to always be kind and give our stuff away, probably we should just do that. And some people do that. And they're just as neurotic as you and me. If they're identified with that. The path to freedom is a pathless path. What does that mean? It means that in our mind, we think we're going someplace, that we're here and we're going to arrive at someplace different, that we're actually going to attain something, that we're going to gain something. That's not how it works. Realization or insights are not little presents that you keep around in boxes. Now I've had the deepest insight into arising and passing. I mean, the mind will do that sometimes. Yes, I've really seen it clearly. Start building up a resume of insights. Well, I've seen impermanence and I've seen unsatisfactoriness, but I haven't seen anatta yet. So that will be the next notch on my diploma that I give myself. Realization is not about things that we get. No one keeps realizations. No one keeps anything. Now, we can keep things nice while we're here with them. But just let's see clearly that it's a transitory, ephemeral set of conditions that we're relating with. And the ephemeral, transitory condition that's relating to those things, yeah, the so-called subject, is also transitory and ephemeral. So, the insight then into arising and passing is relative freedom amidst conditioning. Very important. Very important. This getting steady in this, okay, this is the vehicle, if you will, for awakening. This body-mind process. Getting steady within the conditions of this and how this interfaces with the conditions, what I call the so-called external world, the relationships, the things that you do, places that you go, getting steady amidst that, so that there's evenness, relative balance. I don't mean total, complete absence of all reactivity. I mean when reactivity arises, it's seen for what it is as much of the time as possible, and it arises and passes. There's two things that happen as we awaken, in the relative sense, in the conditioned world of awakening now. We're just talking about that right now. When difficulties and discomforts come, as the awakening is occurring, they don't last as long. They fall away quicker. That's one thing that happens. The other thing that happens in most cases is they're not as intense. They're thinning out, they're thinning out, they're thinning out, they're thinning out. There's less and less and less that can disturb. Now the mind thinks, when this is happening, this is working. I'm going in the right way because things are getting better. Things are getting clarified. I'm feeling better. I'm thinking clearer. I'm misbehaving less. There's less confusion, less fear, less reactivity. I'm kinder, I'm more open. In the relative sense, this is good. But see now clearly, all of that is arising and passing. All of it. None of that lasts. Within that, there is often a diminishment of afflictive desire. Desire, afflictive desire, causes us pain and unhappiness because in the very wanting itself there's unsatisfactoriness and unfulfillment. And what we often don't realize until we do is that when a desire is fulfilled and we feel, there, the actual momentary fulfillment is not because we got what we wanted, it's because desire dissolved. And we mistake getting the object as the fulfillment, when in fact what we didn't see in many cases until we do is that it's the arising and passing Dharma, the truth of cessation. It's the third noble truth of the Buddha that just happened there while you thought that your happiness was born from getting the object. Does that mean, don't care about any objects? No. As desire dissipates, there's more, you could say, organic, or fundamental caring that arises about objects. Because there's less separation and division between objects, like this is better, this is worse, this is more desirable, this is less desirable. And this especially happens for people all the time in intensive practice, and it may arise spontaneously, not so much because I'm talking about it, but because it might just happen, is that all of a sudden, you love your socks. I mean, you really love them. And they're just brown socks or blue socks, and they have a hole in them. And it's just, these are beautiful. They're not even mine, but they're great. Little things. Little things like a shell, a flower. Because you're not busy trying to have some other experience. And what's right in front of you goes, I've been here all along. Where have you been? Where have you been? That's what it would probably say if it could talk. It would say, where have you been? Missing me. Any object can do that. But that's when that object is being seen clearly. It's ephemeral, it's transitory, and yet at the same time, it's all beautifully precious. It's precious because it doesn't last. It's
So most desire then
causes us pain and unhappiness. So this begins to thin out. As we see that desire upon desire upon desire upon desire is like being in a wheel and going round and round and round and round. And I'm not suggesting that we go, okay, let me see if I can just sit. Let me see if I can just do nothing. Let me see if I can just have no desires. There's somebody trying to have no desires. Big, big sticky spot. Flypaper.
Realization or awakening into life isn't about wanting realizations or insights, but rather it's about the correct attitude, the interest, and the openness to see things as they are. This is what all these teachings are pointing at, is to begin to just see things as they are, without interfering, without bias, without prejudice. Or if bias or prejudice arises, then to see that. If struggle arises, then to see that. That has the same nature. It arises and passes also. Correct attitude, interest, and openness. As contrasted from expectations, desire, and trying. This is the proper conditions for insight and for meditation. The teachings are very profound and direct and immediate and also sublime. Talking about everything that is experienced. And of course, the profound, we can only point at that with words. We can't adequately describe it. But in simple terminology, the Dharma, yeah, the truth of the way things are, is comprehended in terms of two basic things. One is the conditioned, and the other is the unconditioned. I've been talking about the conditioned. A few more things. The conditioned is everything that arises and passes. The world, as you know it, including everything that you perceive and know through your senses, outer world, or the body, feelings, thoughts, and memories, are all the conditioned world. They're conditions because they begin and end, they arise and pass. Their condition is impermanence. In Buddhist psychology, it's called sankhara. All conditioned reality is sankhara. Sankhara means mental and or physical, emotional, and the rate at which it moves, yeah, or changes, fast or slow, is up to it. The perception of whether it's inside or outside comes from the identifying tendency that says it's out there or it's in here. Its nature is the same. It's impermanent, it arises and passes. What does that mean then? It means that all conditioned experience, all time-bound things are sankhara. So the meditation on conditioning, which is what we've been doing here for the most part, meditation on conditioning or amidst conditioning, is actually a meditation on ordinariness. Meditation on what's actually just right here. That just comes spontaneously. And then we said, as you know, Steve and I were offering some things, it's like, okay, just you can actually have a sense that you're directing your attention, yeah, to your feet or to your breathing. That you're actually, you think you're making a choice to do that. Okay, you're still in the field of conditionality, you're still in the field of what's unfolding spontaneously, including the arising of the idea that you just chose to do that. That arose spontaneously too. The idea that I made that choice arises spontaneously too. And it disappears spontaneously too. Seeing the relative truth of conditionality, of arising and passing, and seeing how it's unfolding itself, can allow your life to work very well. your life, relatively speaking. It puts your life in order. And you experience relative satisfaction and happiness in this, and relative ease. Of course, it doesn't last. It keeps changing, that happiness and that ease. It's not permanent. But it feels like things are orderly. Your house is in shape. Your life is in shape. But you are still in the realm of conditionality. And if you're identifying with that, you're actually imprisoned in that. Ever so subtly. In some cases. Many people will never realize the unconditioned because they're mesmerized by the conditioned. The unconditioned can't actually be described directly, but it can be pointed at with analogy or metaphor. Many people will never realize this unconditioned because they're enthralled with conditionality. They're caught up in it, and they're bound up in conditionality. When you're bound up, enthralled, infatuated, and seduced by conditionality, the more you are wrapped up in that, the more you will be afraid of death. Because death is loss of that, in many cases, to many people. That's their imagination of it. And that's not entirely, perhaps, wrong, that imagination. Because if we get close to that phenomenon, if we observe death of the body, of an animal, or another human being, we see that something really profound and mysterious is happening, and that we can't get our head around it. But our heart or our being can somehow be touched by that and awakened by that. And for this reason, there's a multiplicity of practices within different traditions, Buddhist tradition to name one, that help us become comfortable, open, familiar with dying, so that we go and find it before it finds us. And I don't mean death in the sense that, you know, we become inert. I mean death, the falling away, the dying of the idea that you're a separate being. And that idea that you're a separate being often means you then have to negotiate your way through this life. You have to figure out how to do it. You have to make it work. You have to succeed at it somehow. And meanwhile, in the back of the mind, and not always the back of the mind, you know the whole thing is going to collapse. And you don't know when. It's right there on your shoulder. So I'm making the point, again, that there's nothing wrong with the conditioned world. It's beautiful, it's tragic, it's full of tastes and colors and angles and shapes of experience. It's ongoing multiplicity. It's a beautiful, amazing realm. It's just not the only thing. And now, it tends to be mesmerizing, because it's believed to be the only thing, and because it's ever-changing and it's the only show in town, then yeah, I'm going to watch the movie. It's a big part of the curriculum here. Yet, believing that it's the only thing there is, why do that? Why believe it's the only thing? Because science says so? Because my mother said so? Because my father said so? Because my grandfather, the wisest guy in the clan, said so? This is it. This is all there is. The rest is hokey pokey. And then there's the whole other side. All of this different religious ideology, doctrine, and dogma that says this is just a really temporary place. There's all these other places that are even better. There's banquets. My dad's sitting around now, if he's awake, he thinks he's going to an everlasting banquet, and everybody's going to be there, and we're all going to be eating and laughing and having fun, and it soothes him to think that way. All the content, all the ever-changing content, all the different tastes and shapes and varieties and textures, the content's always different. It's always changing. That's what's mesmerizing about it. And it's really cool to see that, because that's kind of an insight. It's never the same. It's never the same. It's never the same. But it is the same. How is it the same? It's the same in nature. It's the same at what's called the process level. It's the same in that it doesn't last. It's different in content, but the same in terms of its nature or process. So if I start generating an idea that this is about escape from the realm of conditionality, then I would miss the fundamental teaching as described in the book by Pema Chodron, when she says, the wisdom of no escape. There's a natural opening into something that is not conditioned, as there's comfort and openness and insight into conditions. It's like seeing the sky that's always there, no matter how thick the clouds seem to have gotten. Still there. So here's a metaphor, yeah, or analogy. Yeah. The unconditioned is like the space in this room. The space in this room is here all the time, whether it's being noticed or not. It's still, it's silent. And notice how it doesn't change. Or it seems to not change. It just is. It's isness. Or in Buddhism it's called suchness. The space is suchness. I'm not talking about the air. I'm not talking about the light. I'm talking about the space. Notice how the word space points at space, but can't capture what it is. And yet there's a sense of that, to use that word, the sense of the space. The unconditioned is even more ordinary than the conditioned. We have funny ideas sometimes about the unconditioned. We think it's extraordinary, extraordinary. It's more ordinary than the conditioned. It's so ordinary, it's elusive, yet obvious. And it's, of course, sublime. It's not noticed until there's a release from the conditioned. So even if just pointing at it a little bit, there's a little release from the conditioned. Like in focusing on the space, one may notice that there's a forgetting of the body to some extent, or a forgetting of the thought, or a forgetting of these things that one's been paying attention to. And by the way, you know, the eyes go up, space. Oh, what about the eye? It's all over the place. The earth is in the space. The universe is in the space. All the planets in the space, all the stars in the space. When the space is noticed, yeah, when it's attended to, it can be seen that it's peaceful and it's boundless. The walls of this room can't limit it. Nothing limits it. Why does nothing limit it? Because it's unlimited. This is not the unconditioned, what I'm speaking of. This is an analogy or metaphor that points at it. Now, here's the part for St. Francis, wherever you may be. Yeah? The teaching about the unconditioned in Christianity is the teaching on the peace
that passes all understanding. The peace that passes all understanding is the space within which everything happens.
How do I do, St. Francis?
You walk around this building, you'll see drawings of him. He got a lot of it right in really simple terms. The conditions of views and opinions. Now we're talking specifically about the trickiest stuff. You know, the views and opinions in one's mind about oneself and the world cloud the space often until they're seen in their true nature, which means they arise and pass and they're no longer what they were before. They're just a view, an opinion. They're not the truth. What troubles human beings actually the most, and it's also deeply ironic, is that their views and opinions are not only that which they cling to the most, but it's actually that which, whether they know it or not, trouble them the most. So the views and opinions, we'll just take three examples. The view of gender, for example. This goes away very easily when we meditate. You forget easily, for minutes on a time, that you're a man or a woman. And then you pop back out, open the eyes, look around, and there it subtly may be, or not so subtly. You're sitting there and you're meditating and you completely forget your age. It's irrelevant. But here's the real tricky one. I am this body-mind process. I am meditating. I am watching. I am feeling, I am thinking, I am breathing, I am eating, I am living, I am this. That's a view, that's an opinion. It's a false perception. What I mean by that is that this is not all we are. This is not what we are only. Even just in the forgetting of this a bit, while focusing on, say, the experience of sounds in space, there's a loosening of the identification with the body-mind. A little, a lot. As all that I am. So what's critical to realize is that the conditioned and the unconditioned are not separate. The things that are arising in the space, this is arising in the space. This arose in the space. This is impermanent. This body was conceived. It went through a birthing process. It became relatively independent. But never truly independent. It's completely interconnected and feeds off the life forms around it. Literally is sustained through that exchange. And regardless of what we think about this or believe about this or have an opinion about this, its nature, yeah, is the same for all of us, regardless of gender, regardless of age, regardless of how much we identify with this as singularly what we are. So people sometimes get a false notion that if I stop identifying this with who I am, then will I be able to drive a car or go to work or talk to people? Yes, and even better, it works even better. It flows more easily. The fear of loss of identity is freedom itself. It's not you become inept or enabled or disabled and can't function.
So the space is always present, and it's not bound in any way by the objects that appear in it, because it's boundless. So what we're doing is we're opening up to conditions and experiences so that they can be seen clearly. We're also opening up to how these experiences are being viewed. And we're also opening to spaciousness. We're opening up into that which is unconditioned. Now, this is not a 1-2-3, even though I named it as a 1-2-3. They happen simultaneously. It's a very alchemical, organic process. Opening to spaciousness, opening to and seeing views, opening to experiences, opening to things that are occurring, opening to views, opening to space. All these things intermingle. It's not a 1-2-3. Okay, I opened up to conditions, now I'm ready to open up to views. And now I'm ready to open up to space. It doesn't quite work like that. It's much more organic. There's something extremely intelligent that's really difficult to name. I would call it simply the Dharma itself, and that really doesn't quite get it. It's running the show. It's guiding this. That's meditating itself in a way through you. It's mysterious. And it's safe. It's trustworthy. It's reliable. And it's not a separate thing that guides you. So, the spaciousness of awareness lets us see that sensory consciousness, or what's called samsara, is actually a movement, it's a vibration, it's a changing set of things without a solid substance or permanent essence. This is one of the meanings of emptiness. Emptiness in the sense that doesn't mean nothing. Emptiness in the sense that all these phenomena or conditions are empty of solidity. They're empty of permanence. They're empty of, very important, empty of separateness. They're not separate from one another. So what happens as, you might say, the conditionality meets the unconditioned nature of space, or the unconditioned nature of awareness, as this meeting occurs, form falls open or falls out into spaciousness. This is what the teaching form as emptiness means. Forms show themselves clearly, and there's ease, comfort, relaxation, contentment that follow as byproducts of that. Again, repeating myself a little, there's nothing wrong or bad with conditioning. If you start judging the conditioning, however the conditioning is arising, if you start judging the conditioning, and the condition, let's say you judge it because it hurts. Let's say there's self-judgment in the mind, and then you judge the self-judgment. Okay? This is like, there's some poison ivy on this right arm now. This is like having poison ivy, which already itches, and then going after it. Not a good idea. Better to meditate and simply let the sensations arise and pass. It's very handy. Very handy. Use it in all kinds of situations. Unsure about an action, not sure it's the right thing to do, pause, settle, observe what's arising and passing. Ah, I'm not sure. My doubt's arising and passing. My thought, this might be the right thing to do. Is that doubt or not arising and passing? Stay steady. Watch. Very handy. Conditioning only becomes a problem for us when we
grasp at it or view it as what we are singularly, that's when it becomes a problem for us. That's when it becomes a restriction. Realization or cessation is simply an opening that occurs when nothing is being grasped at, when nothing's being clung onto. Then realization just happens. Opening just happens. And it's not someone who's opening. It's just opening. Can you sense now how the space is ever open? The space is ever open. It doesn't close. It's open. Suffering is the illusion we project onto life because of ignorance manifesting in habits of unawakened living. Suffering is the illusion we project onto life because of ignorance manifesting as habits of unawakened living. In order for this heart-mind to truly awaken, beliefs, theories, projections, assumptions, views, opinions about life, awakening, God, or anything else are essentially useless. They're all empty. The views and opinions, the cherishing of those. What the Buddha was so good about was he was saying, see for yourself what is true. You don't need anybody else's theory, opinion, idea. You don't even need your own theories and opinions, ideas, because those are actually in your way of seeing clearly. See those clearly. See what happens to those when you see those clearly. Find out for yourself what is true. That was really his message, as I understand it. And that was so compelling about what he brought to this earth. These beliefs, theories, projections, assumptions, views, and opinions about life and anything else, they're useless in the sense that they tend to act as filters over the reality of what's actually happening in this direct, intimate, full-contact sport of life. This is a full-contact sport. Okay. Full contact. Wrong perceptions or views in that they obstruct the ever-present unconditioned nature of space. A boundless and unlimited nature of awareness. Awareness is already boundless and unlimited. The only thing that shifts that is when I claim the awareness is mine. It works beautifully, wonderfully, ongoingly, if it's allowed to do its job, if it's not interfered with by claiming it and grasping and saying, this is my awareness. And yet it's the insight into this light of awareness itself that deconditions these views and or perceptions. Awareness itself, in that sense, is illumination. The intimacy of simply being fully aware of what's happening, the sensitivity, the receptivity, is deeply connecting. At times it's unpleasant and it's frictional. At other times it's pleasant and the friction dissipates. At times it's soft and harmonizing. At other times it's very rough and even chaotic. But it's always moving and changing. It's like the ocean. Imagine being the ocean and how it's ever changing and moving. Turbulent, smooth, hot, cold, deep, shallow. It keeps moving and changing. We are that. That's our nature, relatively speaking. So this connectivity, yes, into conditionality, is the heart of the meditation. And it's through this connection that the insights arise, not only into this conditionality, into this connectedness, but beyond it. What's beyond it? What's beyond this connectedness that I'm pointing to is beingness. Beingness, which is one without a second. In pure awareness, beingness, one without a second, appears. Separation completely falls away. And of course, that's impermanent. It's a very, very life-transforming insight
because conditionality and the centrality that it can have into one's life is actually decentralized. It still unfolds, but it doesn't have the same weight. You wonder, don't you? At least I do, why the word enlightenment has come into being if it isn't about a lightening up of the burden. The attempts at completion through seeking union, very important here now, the attempt to seek union in the sensory plane, the attempt to seek union in sensory consciousness, even though you can get relative unity, you can get harmony with other people, you can feel harmony within yourself, you can feel at ease in the body, and you can have a sense that your work and your activities are harmonious and they're connected, and you think about people and you feel connected to them, and they're in body or they're not in body, you feel that. Okay, this connectedness and the attempt to have satisfaction in that ultimately also leads us into pushing and pulling with situations and other beings, demanding, expecting, wanting, grasping, longing, resisting. This struggle, this samsara, this massive bundle of habit is our attempt to transcend the appearance of separation and find completeness. Amazing as it is, our struggle with this is actually hiding, masquerading the deeper struggle of attempting to find completeness and happiness in sensory consciousness. And all that can happen is a temporary satisfaction. Painful and unsatisfactory and ultimately funny truth it is, it never works. We're always left bereft and seeking again. This is the dance in the realm of conditionality. And you wonder why we're so habituated to be in it and playing and having fun and hurting and playing and having fun and hurting. Because so many other beings are doing it. So many other beings are doing it that it's actually quite rare to even consider that there might be something else. And if religion has suggested to you, however it's come to you, that your happiness is when you escape this, when you leave this, when you die and go to a better place, do you trust who's talking to you? Do you trust, really, who wrote that book? Because, you know, you don't actually have to. You don't actually have to trust something unless you really know it yourself. And then trust tends to happen automatically. It's not something you work at. And when that trust deepens, that's faith. Faith is not just about trusting the known, the conditioned. Faith is about openness and connectedness in the unconditioned. It's the peace that passes all understanding. That's what faith is really pointing at. And it's absolutely the opposite of blind. So all of this is possible, yeah, as we look directly at what's occurring. And when we see clearly that wholeness, actually, in the sensory realm is revealed within the apparent separateness of existence. What does that mean? It means that wholeness appears when the I or me dissolves. So I'm sitting on a picnic table having lunch with my daughter many years ago. She's in grade school. And she's having her crackers and cheese, and I don't remember what I was eating. And the I-me dissolves. And all there is openness and wholeness. And it's timeless. And then the I-me comes back and I'm eating crackers with her again. Totally simple. Many people have this dissolution of the I-me into wholeness. It's very simple. It's not that your concept of wholeness now appears when the I dissolves. It's like falling asleep. It's the best way I could describe it. It's like falling asleep but not losing consciousness. The edges just fall away. And everything's just easy and connected. And then it passes. It's very important because you're seeing that not only are the sensations of body and the breathing and the thoughts and the ideas and the sounds and the sights and the smells and the tastes are impermanent. You're seeing clearly. It's being seen clearly, better words. It's being seen clearly that the I or me is impermanent. That it's an idea, it's a conception, it's a belief. That it has no solidity. And this is the taste that the Buddha spoke about. He said the one taste of the teachings is like the ocean. The ocean has but one taste. It's the taste of salt. The teachings have but one taste, and it's the taste of freedom. There has never been and never will never be an enlightened person. This is a complete contradiction of terms. No persons get enlightened, realize nirvana, or get liberated. It's the other way around. As the apparent personal separate vantage point or view of life is seen and seen through, it falls away, leaving the clear sky of original nature, the clear sky of freedom. Aware presence is the one with and yet unbounded by anything that's happening. Aware presence is at one with and unbounded by everything that's happening simultaneously. What's occurring here right now is like-minded humans, as we call ourselves, sitting in the potential of remembering something that appears to have been lost. And it, as it's rediscovered or remembered or recognized, it comes with the certainty that in fact it has never been lost. Something that has never been lost cannot be gained. This is the insight that is the true nature of realization. 17 syllables that capture a moment of life with nature in its unicity. As depicted in the haiku poem, Sister Benedicta, the place where the leaf has left the stem is perfect for just that purpose. The place where the leaf has left the stem is perfect for just that purpose. Let's sit for just a minute or two.